For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson with the latest readout video from our free emailed Wednesday Wake Up newsletter, blah, 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 subscribe, support, and a greeting I will not attempt in Malay to our viewers in Malaysia, which is number 43 on our list of all-time views by country and territory. And, going from the tropics to the pole, a greeting to the new improved Arctic ice of May 2025. As we've said more than once, if you want to be an honest and constructive participant in public debate, it's important to acknowledge evidence that you didn't expect and that doesn't seem to fit your understanding of the world. Ideas are complicated, and there really is no such thing as a beautiful theory slain by a single brute fact. But over time, a theory can be rendered ugly by too many pesky, stinging facts that don't fit. And in our case, we did acknowledge in March that Arctic sea ice was at its lowest level in a decade, the opposite of the situation a year earlier, when we pointed out that it was at a 20-year high, and a lot of alarmists, instead of going, "Oh, that's weird, we didn't see that coming," proceeded to throw a fit at us. So, what will they make of the fact that, after a slow spring, the ice is staging a comeback, having actually tied the decadal high in early May before falling very slightly behind 2003 and 2024 at the time of writing of the newsletter, while still exceeding every other year since 2016? Does it prove that we at CDN are no good rotten scoundrels? Or that ice is part of a plot? Or that too many climate alarmists aren't the kind of people who admit that their theory could be doubted by others who have working hearts and minds? As historian John Lukacs pointedly observed, quote, "People do not have ideas, they choose them," end quote. And it's important to do so with a balanced mix of bold determination and cautious humility. So, for an example of the completely opposite approach, someone with a BSc in weather policy, in case you're wondering with C.S. Lewis what they teach in modern schools, now you know, tells us, quote, "AI-powered climate models leverage sophisticated algorithms and machine learning to process extensive climate-related databases. By simulating various climate scenarios, these models help scientists understand potential future conditions. The incorporation of AI enhances prediction accuracy by up to 30% compared to traditional methods," end quote. But this is a load of codswallop. For starters, because it's saying that one set of predictions we cannot test, because they're about things that haven't happened yet, is 30% more accurate than another set of predictions that we also can't test yet, making the 30% a classic piece of mathiness. And, according to the same source, quote, "these models provide a clearer picture of the urgent need for effective climate policies," end quote. Meaning, they regurgitate the alarmist assumptions of the people who programmed them. We didn't need new and better computers for that, or indeed, computers at all. Ah, and in the newsletter we also mock PBS for announcing that, quote, "Governor Gavin Newsom and state legislators are seeking to extend California's cap-and-trade program, a landmark policy for reducing planet-warming pollution that has found itself in President Trump's sights," end quote. But normally a landmark is something so good that people navigate by it, which is not a good description either of California's plunge into alternative energy or the use of polemical phrases like planet-warming pollution to describe plant food. And, speaking of subnational energy policy debacles, we also want to mention another piece of weed diving by Parker Gallant, who braves the tangles of Ontario energy policy to report on what a preposterous and opaque ripoff it is under a nominally conservative provincial government. Ontario's energy system is incredibly hard to understand, probably on purpose. But Gallant notes that Premier Doug Ford's bellicose, in response to Donald Trump's bellicose tariff threats, surcharge on the excess energy that Ontario exports to the US and Quebec only pushed the export price to $40 per megawatt hour, while locals still pay over $100 per megawatt hour to produce it. So Ford's citizens ended up losing $28.8 million over a single week in April for wind and solar. As Gallant notes, Ford barged into office with populist bluster about cutting power rates and firing fat cat executives, only to settle comfortably into that particular swamp. But in case you think that we at CDN hate the environment, devote our working day to incinerating the earth, and use our spare time to pollute lakes, we'd like you to know that according to a totally disinterested source, quote, "you're an eco-activist with a badge to prove it," end quote. Yay us! By totally disinterested, we mean people who want us to buy more of their supposedly green product, which in this case is used books. So, quote, you've earned the Tree Saver badge, end quote. Who saw that one coming? On the other hand, we did predict that the return of tornado season would blow in the usual hype about trends that aren't there. And on cue, Scientific American says, quote, more tornadoes than usual have already struck the U.S. in 2025, and many of them have been touching down farther east than they had in the past, end quote. Which they obviously blame on climate change, because they always do. But has Tornado Alley historically moved around? Has it gone one way then the other? Don't ask them. They're not that kind of publication. At least, not anymore. In the newsletter, we also note that EVs continue to hypnotize everyone, other than buyers. Canary Media even hypes an outfit that aims to cash in on the burgeoning market for, wait for it, multifamily housing EV chargers. See, quote, by 2030, EVs are expected to make up close to half of all new U.S. car sales, end quote. Read no further. Unless you enjoy puffery like, quote, getting big is a key to 3V's business model, CEO Aubrey Gunnell said, end quote. No, getting big is what happens if you succeed. It's not how you succeed. Unless you're a pyramid scheme, intentionally or otherwise. Meanwhile, if net zero enthusiasts are to get anywhere, or at any rate, if they're to get anywhere they want to be, it will be essential to rely in significant measure on nuclear energy, which interestingly seems to be gaining ground in public opinion generally, especially in the US. Roy Tixera writes on the Liberal Patriot that, quote, Americans love nukes, end quote, with a new Gallup poll showing that in under a decade, positive views of nuclear energy have gone up 17 points and negative views down by 19, taking the net from minus 10 to plus 27. For once, something that unites people across partisan and ideological divides. Yay, right? No. Heatmap warns that, quote, Trump is sabotaging his own nuclear agenda. The president says he wants to bring back nuclear, but he's preparing to eviscerate an office crucial to making that happen, end quote. Well, maybe, but it's unclear. Government is unwieldy no matter who's in power, and good intentions don't get the dogs fed. But nuclear is a proven technology, unlike EVs and their huge missing infrastructure network from generation to delivery. Though nuclear has been hamstrung in the United States for at least 45 years by governments due to weird paranoia about its safety, especially among progressives, that's made permits almost impossible to obtain. So, if small modular reactors are as cool as they sound, and honestly, we're always a little bit wary of anything that trendy, then centralized federal funding on the New Deal model, which is now about a century old, might not be as crucial to them as many progressives seem to assume. We also note that the United States needs nuclear less than a lot of countries because it is a hydrocarbon superpower. But there are many advantages to this sort of power generation, from geopolitical to economic to, yes, environmental. So maybe something good is happening on this file, even if Orange Man bad. And everyone better hope so, because one of the significant problems with green energy is the lack of energy, and the other is the lack of green. In which regard, we are vaguely encouraged to get an email from Canary Media about a new plan to recycle solar. Especially because the article does concede that solar panels are a major environmental hazard, including, quote, each time a hurricane batters Florida, the country's second largest market for solar energy, broken panels pile up in landfills, end quote. Which seems to combine unreliability and pollution in one big ugly pile. And, we can't help noticing, doesn't seem to be a problem that affects gas-fired or nuclear plants. Canary Media then praises One Planet Solar Recycling as a startup, which nowadays conveys cool images of smart rebels breaking models, though it's another way of saying that the firm isn't yet successful in the sense of making money selling things people want. And here let us digress to confess to a genuine, if possibly naive, puzzlement that mining companies generally don't pay to dig up existing landfills in North America and Europe, given all the effort that goes into extracting metal from virgin ore by going somewhere remote with huge expensive machines, digging up rocks, crushing them, and then doing some energy-intensive thing or another that probably involves caustic chemicals. You'd think that digging up trash, burning the eggshells and mattress stuffing, and keeping the already refined metal would make economic sense. But apparently it doesn't, since people don't do it. Unless it's just that governments don't let them, which isn't inconceivable either. So, to get back to the solar venture, by the same token, it seems like a no-brainer to take the solar panels that were already manufactured, but quickly shattered or wore out, and toss them back into the smelter, instead of going through the expensive and environmentally destructive process of extracting and shipping the raw materials to make new ones. And then we think, well, yeah, but if it did, somebody in a relatively free market economy would have started doing it long ago, wouldn't they? And then we think, well, someone has to go first. So, we wish them well. Just not, please, with subsidies that make it look efficient when it's not. As with solar energy generally. Because you famously cannot dig your way out of a hole. In the newsletter, we then say look it up. Way up. Because clouds are where the action is. See, in climate models, CO2 doesn't actually do most of the warming. Instead, it causes a small increase in temperature, which makes the air absorb more water vapor. And water vapor is a truly potent greenhouse gas, so it supposedly then cooks the planet. But in practice, the observed concentration of water in the air, that's the specific humidity, as opposed to the maximum possible at any given temperature, the relative humidity, is not rising as the models expect, as you can see for yourself on Professor Ole Holmlund's Climate For You website. So, another one bites the mist. And another thing. By now you all know about RCP 8.5, the spicy secret sauce in climate alarmist projections that run an impossible scenario of future emissions through a computer model, generate a wildly implausible catastrophe, and then call it the no policy or business as usual baseline, proving that we need an aggressive policy response. But eventually people started detecting the unpleasant flavor of RCP 8.5 in every dish, so the modeling crowd changed the menu. But not the ingredients, which they simply relabeled from Representative Concentration Pathways, RCP, to Shared Socioeconomic Pathways, SSP. And before anyone could point out that the burnt chicken all tasted the same anyway, they announced a new, improved set of dishes. But as Roger Pilkey Jr. is documenting in a new series at his Substack, they just renamed the same old muck. So, the new SSP 3-7.0 scenario tastes just as bad, and it does so for a reason. As RPJ demonstrates, the current mix of primary energy in the world is just over a quarter coal, and that share is falling. But the new high-end SSP 3-7.0 scenario has it mysteriously rise to over half by 2100. Nobody knows how. But we know why, and it's one dish that we're sending back uneaten. And speaking of eating, from the CO2science.org archive, rosewort, or Dalbergia latifolia, is a tree native to the Indian subcontinent, prized for making fine furniture as well as musical instruments. And according to CO2science.org, in 2007 and 2009, there were 7 experiments that showed that under an additional 300 parts per million of CO2 in the air, seedlings of this tree species experienced an average growth boost of 55.6%. So, there won't just be more food on the table, there will be more tables, more chairs, and possibly more violins to play music while you eat. For the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and my skepticism is on ice.